America,
the S&P,
the ASX stocks.
This is Motley Fool Money.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money, the podcast that loves any excuse for a good anniversary celebration. Well, almost.
Oh, hey, break out the champagne.
Hold that thought.
Oh.
I'm Andrew Page, and with me is Scott Phillips.
G'day, Andrew. G'day, fools. It's good to be with you.
It is, as always.
Even though
we're going to be celebrating?
Commemorating.
Commemorating. A couple of interesting anniversaries.
Let's do it.
On the podcast today, what can investors learn from the smashing success of the Everest?
What, the mountain?
The horse race.
Right.
The 30th anniversary of Black Tuesday.
Bum, bum, bum.
Oh, are we in for another crash?
That's today. We're recording this on Friday, the 20th of October.
Yes.
30 years ago today.
Yes, indeed. And lots of interesting facts and tidbits there.
Speaking of crashing and terrible things.
Well, the end of an era for Aussie car manufacturing. Holden is closing its plant.
Indeed, a sad day.
And I'm going to get on my high horse and give you guys a good rant, just because I can and I want to.
Because I've got a soapbox. Exactly.
And you're going to sit there and you're going to enjoy
it. If people are stupid enough to open their microphones to let us talk, we're going to talk. And frankly, week on week, either you're going to rant or I'm going to rant, because that's just what we do.
Whether it's justified or not.
Podcast listeners, you are doing us an app. In fact, you're not doing us a favor. You're doing our colleagues a favor, because the more we rant here, the less we rant back at the office. And they thank you for it.
It's cathartic. It's therapeutic.
All those good things.
Tell me about the Everest.
The Everest is a really, it's a really, really big mountain.
Really?
Yeah, but massive.
Oh, that's
actually, funnily enough,
okay, next topic.
Triple M's own Matty Johns is climbing Mount Everest as we speak.
Wow.
Which is pretty cool. But that's not the Everest we're talking about. We're talking about the horse race.
Okay. Where's it at?
The race that didn't quite stop the nation, but made $1 squillion instead.
Mm-hmm.
I think the brains behind it might be hoping it rivals the Melbourne Cup at some point. Only 100 years or so worth of history to take that mantle. But the richest horse race, and really, really interesting structure. And that's why we want to talk about it today.
Well, tell me all about it, because you know a lot more about it than I do.
Which is not saying much. But
I'm the guy who when we were talking about horses last week, I was saying, here, boy.
Here, boy.
So I'm an expert on horses.
All those four-legged things are the same, aren't
they? They're all the
same. All right. The Everest is a horse race. And interestingly enough, it was kind of done... Lots of parallels to, ironically, professional gambling.
Okay.
The interesting thing about this is each of the slots in the race was sold to a bidder who basically bid for the right to put their own horse or someone else's horse into the race on their behalf.
No. I got to stop you there, because again, I'm super naive here. What is normally, how does that normally
right,
work?
Well, so effectively, normally you get invited to take part in a race. They're a big race. If it's a little race, I'll take anyone who wants to come and turn up.
Right.
You normally have to pay a not unreasonable entrance fee, and then there's prize money at the end.
Okay.
So that's kind of how it works.
Okay.
The Melbourne Cup has big prize money, of course, and you have to pay a lot more to get in.
Mm-hmm.
But broadly, it's still the same kind of idea. The handicappers work out who can enter the race based on certain criteria, and they let that happen.
Okay.
In this case, it was a very, very different thing. They basically said, look, let's start with let's just sell this incredibly expensive, lots of prize money, $10 million pool for prize money, I want to say.
Right.
And so they basically said, look, anyone who wants to bid for these slots can bid for them.
And so you and I could bid for one? And
not
then,
you and I, mate. Neither you nor I have enough money to bid for a slot in this particular race. Okay. But conceptually,
in another
universe.
Well, you and I bid for
one. We're independently wealthy and not doing a podcast. We would be lounging on our yachts in Greece and instructing Jeeves to go and put a bid on for a slot in this race.
Okay. So we do that.
Yeah.
And then we can fill that with any horse jockey combo we
right.
Want.
Well, okay. you've got to want to do it, of course, and the jockey, blah, blah, blah. But yes, exactly. You can nominate your horse to take your slot. The trainers and the owners of the horses get to say, well, look, we'd love to take it, please. Or they can say, well, we will take that slot, but we want a certain share of the prize money, because the prize money in the first instance goes to the slot owner, not the connections of the horse. This is where it's different.
You.
So normally the connections of the horse, the owners would say, I want to put my horse, Andrew's Follies, into the Melbourne Cup.
Yep.
I'm going to pay my tens and hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of entry fee,
and
I'll get all the prize money.
Yep.
In this case, the slot is owned by somebody else. And so...
And it's up to them to negotiate.
Right. Both which horse they get, how much they give that horse, all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why this is a really interesting difference. It's most akin to... If you ever watch High Stakes Poker...
I was going to say, it sounds familiar.
Right. Yep. So the poker players that we all focus on are winning and losing big money.
Yep.
What goes on behind the scenes, and why we're talking about it in a finance podcast, is because most of those poker players have a backer or a series of backers who basically stake those players.
They
give them some money to play with. And they're playing the odds themselves.
Right.
So in this case, what we think about it's easy to think about professional poker players as akin to professional athletes who are out there working for their own money. It's a different scenario here because I don't get all the winnings. They don't suffer all the losses. Mm. They say, I'm a good poker player. Mm-hmm. If you want some of my winnings, come and stake me, come and bankroll me for my money, mm-hmm. and we'll make this work.
Right.
And so you get this idea of kind of the backer and the player, or in this case, the backer and the horse or the mm-hmm. jockey, mm-hmm. who are in concert trying to win the prize money that's on offer. So it's okay. a really interesting way to go about and to think about how you think about the kind of the financial components of poker or of horse racing. Mm. It's frankly... Rather than buying the horse outright, you buy a slot, you back a horse. You're taking a much more nuanced approach to investing
yep.
in the potential for winning, whether it's poker or horse racing,
yep.
than just saying, I'll be the poker player or I'll buy the horse.
Mm.
You're choosing to back a particular horse and then sharing the proceeds accordingly.
And you can switch and change as you see fit.
When you think about poker, you know, people who back poker players normally aren't just bankrolling one guy.
Mm.
They're bankrolling half a dozen guys.
Gotcha.
Or each poker player has half a dozen backers, all putting in a bit of money each. So it's very much, you know, when you get to it, it's not so different, very different, of course, on one level, but not so different to buying shares in a company.
Yeah.
The poker player has a whole lot of shares in that poker player.
Mm-hmm.
They're out there doing work on behalf of the owners in this case, or the bankrollers.
Yep.
And again, as an investor, you win or lose based on the performance of the investment you're making, which in this case happens to be in a slot at the races or in a poker player at the tables.
Very interesting stuff.
Really, really cool. And it was a smashing success. They had massive lines. People love the idea, the prize money, the media coverage. I wouldn't be at all surprised if this is the birth of a new iconic race for Australia.
Yeah, very interesting. Well, we'll keep eyes on that.
And now, maybe one day we'll have a slot.
Maybe
or a horse.
One day.
Or a horse.
Isn't that like tearing up $100 bills while having a cold shower? I've heard it like buying a boat, you know. It's one of those things that's
yeah,
a very romantic
cool
idea, but then you just bleed. And
we all get to go to the
cash.
Owner's enclosure. We've got, you know, the full filly. No?
I'm going to pass, mate. Right. I like money.
Motley Fool Money. Financial advice for real people, not trust fund hippies. Sign up for the newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM.
So let's speaking of money and how quickly that can disappear.
Indeed.
30 years ago today, it was the 20th of October, 1987.
1987?
You were probably only 40 or something at that stage.
Nice.
Sorry, mate.
35, and, very much.
Right, okay. And we had the biggest one-day crash in history.
23% on the US market on their 19th, our 20th of October.
Yep.
Enormous, and it just an absolute overnight pummeling of the markets.
And it was a phenomenal, it was really interesting for a couple of reasons. One, it was the magnitude of the crash was just huge. Two, it started in Hong Kong and then just reverberated around the world. But when we look at the tech wreck, when we look at the GFC, when we look at the tulip bubble, when we look at all of these market crashes, obviously it's not obvious at the time, but in hindsight, the boffins can look back and go, it was all about debt. All about ridiculous
mania.
Valuations. Yep. Yep. It was all about this. And there's really wonderful lessons. The fascinating thing about 1987 is there's not really an obvious cause for it.
Yeah, so I'm going to take it back half a step because the 23% fall, unlike all of those things you talked about, unlike the GFC, unlike the dot-com boom, unlike all of that stuff, the fall that happened in one day.
Yeah.
So the GFC was a massive meltdown. The market lost 45-odd% of its value. Mm. But over an extended period of over weeks and months, just bits and bits, chipped off.
Yep.
The market lost confidence. Investors walked away. It was kind of this kind of rolling, rumbling avalanche, if you like, but almost in slow motion.
Yep. Yep.
In this case, this was far more like just a piece of an ice sheet breaking off all of a sudden. It literally just cracked and disappeared. And it was, you know, a quarter of the market's value among friends, call it 25%, 23%.
Yep.
A quarter of the market's value, literally, in the space of one trading day, 6 hours, give or take, gone. Completely gone.
And yeah, it's one of these things too that I think very understandably a lot of people sort of point to as reasons as to why the stock market is so dangerous.
Yeah.
And frankly, it's a very, very good example if you're approaching the stock market in a particular way.
I think this is why it was so scary, because you asked the question about the why. Mm. And normally you can say, well, if you've just seen the amount of debt, if you've just seen the amount of speculation, if you've just seen the geopolitical challenges, and frankly, they're always, I think, even though they're obvious in hindsight, as you say, people always not diagnose these things after the fact. No one saw the subprime crisis coming, except everyone claims in hindsight to have seen it. The 87 crash, though, was interesting because it was literally, effectively just a stock market only crash. There was no broader economic issue, at least at the time. There were subsequent recessions, but not because of it. And it wasn't caused by this. So you have this really strange scenario where the 87 crash happens, everything just falls out of bed.
Yeah.
And no one sees it coming, no one knows why it's happening. Yep. All they see on their screens is price just falling and falling and falling and falling. There's a really cool anecdote on Twitter this morning of some guy saying, He said, I want to sell IBM. And the guy said, I'll give you $98 a share. And the trader says, well, it says 119 on my computer. He says, well, sell it to your computer then. You know, and that was what it was. Everything was falling so fast, so quickly. And this is the very, very, very early stages of computerized trading, which we'll come back to.
Yeah.
And so at that point, it's kind of like, dude, you want to make the sale or don't you?
Yeah.
And when the market's in free fall, you can imagine 6 hours feels like nothing, and it is.
Yeah.
But imagine you're at a desk
mm.
and the time's going past at 60 seconds a minute, which feels really, really slow in the event.
Yeah.
And all you're seeing in front of you is prices falling and falling further. So at 10:05, at 10:30, at 11 o'clock, at 11:20, at 11:40. And every time you look at your computer, there's more red, there's more falls, there's more. Mm. And you think, where the hell does this stop?
Yeah.
And so you're saying, well, I want to get out of company X, in this case it was IBM. Mm. I want to sell someone because I don't want to do it.
Yeah.
Someone's offering you 20% less than it said on the computer screen. You're like, well, dude, you either want it or
take
you don't.
Take it.
It's a buyer's market,
yeah.
right?
Yeah. And especially when you don't know what's going on.
Like right.
You're going to assume the worst. Fear kicks in. Here's the other thing. So if you had bought at the top of the market, it would have taken a lot. It was early 1994 before the All Ordinaries, and this is just a price index without factoring in dividends.
Yeah. Which we should, but we won't.
We should, but we don't, because we couldn't easily find the data, if we're being honest.
The hours of painstaking preparation we put in this program, it's hard to believe we couldn't find the information.
We've got to fire our researchers, mate. It took 7 long years for that to come back. And even then, it touched it, and then it's sort of weighing down again. And it's one of those things that people will often say, well, look, even long-term investing is dangerous, because I could have done all of the right things, but it took all of that time to come back. But here's the thing. It's a question of where you're sort of picking your starting point.
So if we take the top of the 87 crash,
so
the top of the market before the crash, it took 7 years to make the money back.
7 years to make the money back,
right.
And then it was there for a second, and then it went away again, and then you had to wait a little bit longer for it to come back. But here's the other interesting thing. At the start of 1987, the market was doing its thing. It rallied up. It actually almost doubled and then it fell away. So it kind of, if you happened to go to Antarctica for that year, you would have looked at the market before you left. You would have looked at the market when you came back, and it was about the same. There was not a huge difference.
So I don't know if we have the numbers here for the ASX, but I do know in the US, the market actually closed up 2% for 1987.
It's amazing.
So January 1 to December 31, market's up 2%,
yes.
Despite the biggest fall of all time, the 23% fall on the 19th of October there. And this is so you asked about the causes. I think that's two things. One is that yes, there was an astonishing rise during 87, which really kind of to some degree actually mirrors the 2007 rise. That was, people got a little bit carried away. So there wasn't a mania as such, but
irrational
when share
exuberance.
Prices double in the space of 10 months, really, if it falls back, you can't really say you were surprised, right? So part of it is simply that things got way overheated. And so that's important. The second is that there is a general belief or supposition, because we can't prove any of this stuff.
Yeah.
I mentioned before this was the beginning of computerized trading, and there is very much a sense that this may well have been a case of computers who are programmed to sell when the prices fall, actually exacerbating that problem.
And
so,
in fact, causing it in the first place.
Right.
They were causing prices to rise so dramatically as well.
Correct. So you sort of add those two together. It's possibly part of the reason. There is no clear cut. No one can actually say, even with the benefit of 30 years hindsight, this is what caused it. But there's a general belief that one of the largest contributors was probably the early days of computerized trading, when the algorithms weren't very smart. The programming was very, or relatively, I won't say amateurish, that's unfair, but certainly simplistic and not allowing for the things that would subsequently happen.
Now, mate, when we were doing our highly detailed due diligence,
hours and hours of research
in preparation for this podcast,
over a
we logged onto a website, we brought up the chart, and it actually took a moment to find the crash. One of the biggest crashes, where is it? Now, giveaway was that it was the 1987 crash, so we probably should have looked a little closer at the x-axis.
If only there was a way to put the year into this spreadsheet.
But I think both of us were a little bit surprised. We just thought we'll just eyeball it. We'll just go back and you'll just see where it is.
Yeah.
But again, this is an audio medium, so we're not going to be able to do it any justice. But do yourself a favor, jump onto Google Finance to bring it up, and you will see that there's these tiny little tick up and tick
Andrew,
down.
Andrew, I've got an even better idea.
Okay.
Google Finance is for amateurs.
All right.
People should jump onto Twitter and go to @TheMotleyFoolAU.
Oh, there you go.
One word, @TheMotleyFoolAU. I tweeted it this morning. Actually, you can also go to @TMFScottP. Choose your Twitter account. I tweeted it this morning. I will, right now, as we speak, due to the miracle of modern technology, retweet that. So if you, as you're listening to this, go to @TheMotleyFoolAU, and you will find a copy of that chart. We can almost, maybe if you look really closely, find the crash.
It's just amazing, isn't it? So what did we learn?
This is a beautiful Dorothy Dixon, mate. Thank you. I really appreciate that. I was asked that also on Twitter this morning. I don't spend all of my time on Twitter, but when I do, as the meme says, I like to ruminate as to the causes of the crash. And it's a really good question. You know, the what did we learn is probably it's the right question, but there's no good answer, because the reality is, and I said this in less than 140 characters. I don't like quoting myself.
If you can't say it in less than 140 characters, it's not worth saying. Let's
exactly. So we were at least 15 minutes over time already. But I said, you know, so the question was, what did we learn? And I said, markets are volatile and unpredictable.
Yep.
Investors overreact.
Yep.
And leverage kills.
Yep.
Wait a second. And those are very...
Didn't we know that already?
That's the point, right? Yeah. Is that what did we learn from 87? Nothing that we should have known in 1985.
Yeah.
What did we learn from the GFC, from the dot-com crash, from the all of these things over again?
Yeah.
You know, if the financial memory is probably the shortest memory, I think, in recorded human history, our inability to really learn from that past. Markets have always been unpredictable since the tulip bubble you mentioned already.
Yeah.
Leverage, of course, it can kill. By definition, it's leveraging, it's magnifying your gains and losses. Mm. And investors overreact. Otherwise, markets would go up in a nice, clean, straight line. So to your point, yes, absolutely. This was madness that it happened, that the rise happened, madness that the fall happened, madness that people overreacted. But I want to take you back to one thing, Andrew, before we move on, and we need to, is the, and this, it's important that we spend a bit of time on this, because this is kind of one of the most seminal moments of recent financial history.
Yeah.
You make the point about the 2% gain during that year, right?
Right.
The humans love thinking about the tops and bottoms. We kind of mentally say, where's the top, where's the bottom, what's the difference? Losing 23% is the headline, right? Mm. And we do it and everyone does it. If you'd have done nothing but A, hold your shares, you made money during 87.
Yep.
And if you'd been buying every month, $100 a month, right through 83, 84, 85, 86, 87, and onwards after that, the peak and trough were such short periods of time.
Yeah.
If you'd have bought for 5 years before and 5 years after, only during one of those years were you buying at what subsequently seemed to be inflated prices.
Mm.
And so bearing the grief of that fall was the price of massive, massive, massive compound returns. And that's the important part. If you just look at the top and bottom, of course you're going to say that's terrible.
Sure.
If you'd simply invested money the entire time and ignored the index, as you say, you would have made a squillion bucks. And that's the key message here, I think.
It's that old saying. It's so well-worn, but it's so good. It's that it's not timing the market, it's time in the market.
Oh, hey.
Love it.
You should write coffee table books.
I really should.
Real money advice from real people. Not just a couple of dicks with a Porsche. Get more at fool.com.au/MMM.
Let's move on, mate. There was another anniversary of sorts. Is the last Holden is rolling off the assembly line.
Yeah,
today.
Not anniversary yet, but it will be in future years. This is the end, literally yesterday, the 19th. Thursday was the day the last car was built at the Holden plant.
69 years after the first one rolled off.
Indeed, workers down tools yesterday. The car is being unveiled, released, whatever fancy word you want to use. A bit of a bittersweet day. I know you're a Tesla man, but I grew up a Holden fan, watching Peter Brock do laps of the Peter Perfect, laps of Mount Panorama in his Holdens with the occasional little bit of diversion to Ford, but we won't talk about the Sierra. It's you know, football, meat pies, kangaroos and Holden cars, right? It is literally that iconic. Ford as well, obviously manufacturing here, and I won't take sides in the Blue Oval versus the Red Line debate, but what I will say is Holden was Australia's car company as much as it was owned by GM. And so to some degree, this is kind of a sad day for all of us. It's a recognition
sad.
That the past is no longer here. The future is not in manufacturing in Australia. That has its downsides. It has its detractors.
Mm.
But it's also just kind of the reality. It's probably 30 years too late. We probably shouldn't have been manufacturing cars over the last 20 or 30 years. But in any case, it's the end of an era. People out of work, suppliers out of work. Towns and cities that really will feel the brunt of this for a couple of years to come. It's a tough time, but it probably is something that was well overdue, I think.
Well, this is what I want to dig into. So there's very real human consequences to all of this, and we don't want to sort of gloss over that. But you said that it shouldn't have gone as long as it did. What do you mean by that? Why not?
Yeah, I think I do want to repeat, and I said it a bit myself, and you've said it then. But you know, we're a finance podcast, but. We're the first to win, and frankly, one of the loudest voices to say that finance doesn't exist in a vacuum. It's all part of a society, and there are real and serious human impacts here. So whatever we say now subsequently is all about the finance realities, and they are realities, but we're not blind or unaware of the human cost.
Yep.
The challenge for Australian manufacturing is that we are exactly the wrong country to do low value-add manufacturing.
Why?
Because we have two massive disadvantages.
Okay.
The first is our average wages are very high.
Yep.
And that's great for standards of living. So we should never, there are those who will say, if our wages were low, we'd make more cars. It's like, yep, absolutely, dude. And if you want to go on fewer holidays and work Saturdays and get paid half what you get paid, then by all means, line up at the queue.
Yep.
But it'd be a very, very short queue because that's just the reality. As a country, we enjoy
they think about that in Bangladesh, right?
Right. We enjoy a much, much higher standard of living because of that.
Yep.
And if that means we don't manufacture quite as many things, that's a really easy trade-off to make. Mm-hmm. But we are a high-wage country. The second is we're a small country in population terms, and we're a bloody long way from almost anywhere else. And so if you think about the large car plants, the Volkswagen plants in Argentina and South Africa, I should say, the Korean and Thai car companies and the Korean and Thai car plants, Indonesia, the places that very, very large numbers of cars are being made, exported right around the world, they are making 10, 20, 50 times the number of cars we make.
Mm.
So if you think about the combination of a high per hour wage and a much lower in Australia, scale benefit. Mm-hmm. In other words, if you're only making 100 cars a day versus 1,000 cars a day, the scale benefit just doesn't accrue to you. And so you've got countries that are closer to their markets with much higher scale, with much lower worker costs. And the question really is, why would an Australian car be competitive? And the answer is it can't be and it won't be. And that's the fundamental problem. It's been the case for 30 years. Governments have propped up the car industry for three decades and more with subsidy after subsidy after subsidy. The cost per job is in the millions of dollars.
Yeah.
It's unaffordable. It's unreasonable from a policy perspective, notwithstanding the human impact.
Well, even factoring
I'm not going to get paid $1 million by the government to keep my job if all of a sudden someone decides the Motley Fool is a bad business and we don't want to give financial advice in Australia. No one's going to pay the Motley Fool $1 million a year to keep me in a job, and nor should they.
Well, that's the hard part. It's one of the wonderful things about capitalism is we have these feedback mechanisms that sort of drive efficiencies and improve standards of living all around. And really, in Australia, we found a better way to make cars. And the way that we make cars now is that we dig up a bunch of iron and we put it on a boat. And then that boat comes back with cars on it. It is much, much more efficient to make a car that way. And when I say make a car that way, it's all about comparative advantages. We're really good at mining. We've got some really wonderful resources. We've got some really good technologies. We can produce at some of the lowest costs that are out there. And certainly better than Japan can. Wouldn't it make sense for us to do things that we're really, really, really good at?
Yep.
And we'll do that. And, you know, over in Japan, you guys do what you're really, really good at, and we'll trade with each other. And you get what you need, we get what we need, and we do it in a far, far, far more efficient manner.
I'm going to try really hard not to bang on here, because it's not my rant, it's your rant this week. So the whole neoliberalism thing, right? There's plenty of people out there in politics and in the media and in the commentary right now who will decry neoliberalism, and I don't want to get involved in that because I don't have any interest in name-calling or taking sides. As it turns out, it probably has gone too far, but that's not the key issue.
Mm-hmm.
The simple reality is that free trade, international trade, allows us to exchange our mutual benefits, our mutual advantages. The whole idea of capitalism from the very first day someone said, I'll swap you a grain of rice if you swap me a grain of wheat. The very first day that happened, the reality was if I can make cars and you can grow wheat, or if I've got great tourism and you've got great manufacturing, then we should absolutely each try and do that. If we had to try and have our own rice growing and cotton growing, and wheat growing, and wool growing, as well as our own car manufacturing, computer manufacturing, we couldn't do it all.
No.
We'd end up being communist Russia, and the simple reality is we don't have that advantage.
Yeah.
We are far, far better off exchanging with Japan, as you say, or America or China, what we're good at and have a lot of and can do well and cheaply, with what they have a lot of, they do well and do cheaply.
Yeah.
As it turns out, we've got really cheap access to iron ore.
Mm-hmm.
They've got really cheap access to labor.
Mm.
Now, we can say to them, you mine your own iron ore, and build your own cars. We'll mine our own or build our own cars.
Mm.
It doesn't work that way. And our standard of living, although it's imperceptible from day to day, our standard of living is much, much higher by virtue of international trade and even interstate trade for what it's worth than if we had to do everything in our own backyard. Now, there are environmental and economic consequences. There are absolutely social consequences. And governments should, as I've said many times before, be alert to that and being responsible to that, fixing those sort of problems that exist and occur as a result, but it's not an excuse to go back, close the borders and say, no, thanks very much, Jack, we'll do it all ourselves. Otherwise, guess what, guys? We're going back to the 1950s with a standard of living that says one television in black and white, one car if you're lucky, one telephone at the end of the street. If you want that, that's great. Just be careful what you wish for.
And we can actually do it in a way where we ease some of these frictions as well. As you mentioned, there's been a lot of money poured into trying to prop up these things. You take a fraction of that. You give some very generous severance packages to the people who are most directly affected. You pump a bunch of money into training. You actually help those people far more than you have. You know, even though it's not as obvious, it is something that is better for everyone. And I'd like to say that we would learn this lesson, but we don't. It just comes up again and again. And,
oh, mate.
You know, there's a Polly in a high-vis vest somewhere talking about,
everywhere.
40 employees who are going to suffer. And you feel for these people, but at the same time, you're not helping them. You're not helping the country. You've got to think big. You've got to think holistically.
Now, I'll say too quickly, and we try and be relatively apolitical. We don't resile from having views on policy, but we try to avoid politics.
Mm-hmm.
There are different things. I will say, for what it's worth, I've been pretty critical of the government recently. Mm-hmm. Fair chance to take a swing at the opposition. The Labor policy with this $1 billion bloody fund for investing in manufacturing is just more picking winners. And I get they're a labor organization. I get they care about jobs. We care about jobs.
Of course we do.
There are many, many better ways to achieve that than trying to pick winners with a $1 billion fund.
Yep.
It's exactly the mistakes of the car industry all over again.
Yeah.
I get it. I get why they think it's a good idea. I get why they want it to be a good idea. Mm. It's just not. And whether that's political pressure, whether it's union pressure, whether it's ideological pressure, I don't know. They're doing some great things. The government are doing some great things. They both also do some terrible things. And this is one where the opposition needs to kind of just say, guys, we've been there, we've done that. There are better ways to support Australians, support Australian jobs, support Australian industry, and frankly, our standard of living, than throwing $1 billion at the possibility that maybe eventually someone will come up with a better car or a better something else. We've been there and done that for the last 30 years. It's cost us a squillion. They really should just say, we're sad to see it go, but we've learnt the lessons and we're moving on.
Mate, I almost don't need to do a rant this week. I think we've both had a pretty good run right there.
Get more Motley Fool money advice at fool.com.au/MMM.
I'm going to do another rant anyway.
Here we go.
We don't have any sound effects this week, which is a bit disappointing.
Oh, Liam is down in... Liam Flanagan, who is the best young MMM football caller you'll hear, is unfortunately in Melbourne today.
Yep.
So we're here.
Unfortunately for us.
Well, yeah. We're in the studio by ourselves,
mm-hmm.
which means this podcast will go for a very, very long time. But
get comfortable.
Liam is with us in spirit. And frankly, we've got to see him next week if we go too long. So we'll wrap up with a rant sans sound effect.
Well, here's what gets my goat. And look, it's an understandable one. So I've got to be delicate given the job I have and the stuff that I do. But, you know,
oh, no.
What is really bizarre, I find, is that we talked about behavioral biases last week. And a big one is that confirmation bias.
Mm.
And we see this kind of stuff all the time where people will like a certain company, we'll talk about it. And then someone becomes aware of the alternate viewpoint, the bear case to the bull or the bull case to the bear. And people get very, very worried about that kind of stuff. All of a sudden, it makes things more confusing. It makes things less certain. If there is one thing that sells in this game of ours, mate, it is certainty. So whenever you create uncertainty, and we will do it within our organization, the name The Motley Fool, we very much, you know, we are a Motley crew.
Yes.
Not the Motley crew, unfortunately. our fans aren't, they're very different.
Our lawyers would probably say copyright, trademark, Motley Crew Incorporated.
Yeah, absolutely.
Used under license.
But what's really cool about our business is that the boss doesn't require us to have a house view. So the service you run, you can come out there and you can say, BHP sucks. And I can say, I love it. It's the best thing in the world. And we don't have to agree.
Yep.
But it does cause some cognitive dissonance amongst people, understandably so. But I guess the thing that I'd really like to emphasize to anyone who's investing in the market or thinking of investing in the market is that you have to get very, very comfortable with people disagreeing with you.
Yep.
Whenever you do anything on the share market, you are, by definition, taking the opposing view to someone else.
Yes.
If I want to buy some shares, someone has to sell them to me.
Correct.
If I want to sell some shares, someone has to buy it. By definition, they have a different point of view.
You are seeking it. You're actively seeking out the guy who says, I think you're wrong.
Yeah, you want
by
that
definition.
Guy.
Right,
you
right.
want that guy.
And I'm going to make a fortune with those shares.
Yes. And he's like, I want to get rid of him.
Right.
You know? And
if he loves them and you love them, you're not going to pay a price low enough and he's not going to get a price high enough.
Well, he's just not going to sell, right?
Exactly.
And then to get anyone to sell, the price is probably going to have to be really, really, really high. So get used to it. And here's the other thing I would say is that when you come across this stuff, it's very natural to dismiss it. You know, if I like a particular, and we do this all the time because we're human and it's very hard to avoid, but you and I will be chatting about a company and you go, oh, I like that one too. And isn't this great? Oh, that's so cool. And da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And you are the exactly wrong person that I should be speaking to.
What
I need to
much.
Do is find the guy, the girl that totally disagrees with me.
Right, right.
That is the value. The best investors in the world seek out the opposing view. They take it incredibly serious. It doesn't mean they, flip-flop around. You have to have have conviction in this game, but you have to consider the alternative. You have to take it very seriously, and you have to be able to very confidently stick to your guns in light of that.
Okay, but you've got someone smart who's selling. Mm. You know they're selling. Mm. Why are you so arrogant as to believe you're right and they're wrong?
Well, I think one of the things that you should do as an investor is that you need to be able to argue the opposing view better than the person who has that view. So if I say I like Altium, for example, you need to be able to, I need to obviously have a very good reason to articulate that. It's a very good reason
this
to support my thesis.
This is a printed circuit board maker, if there's a heard of Altium.
Yeah, well, we sold it on our surface recently, hence a little bit of this rant, frankly.
Now we're getting to the number. This is a spleen venting session.
Well, look, it comes up all the time. And it's
so you sold and someone's gone, hang on, other people still like it.
Yeah, what's
Why
going
the hell are you
on?
Selling?
Yeah, what's, and it's like, well, I've got a different point of view. So, but what I need to be able to do is if someone says, well, why aren't they? I think it's very, very, very useful skill for me to be able to give an honest, candid, and fair interpretation of their argument better than they can. If I can't do that, then I am very, very likely suffering from a whole host of these behavioral biases we talked about last week, and I am probably making a mistake. And when things, or if things start to go wrong, I'm probably going to compound those mistakes. So you have to, here's the thing with investing, and it's this really fine line. You have to have conviction.
Yep.
You've got to have, if you don't have conviction, you'll be flip-flopping, you'll be buying, you'll be selling, you'll be changing your mind, it'll be a disaster, you'll lose all your money.
You've got to have
guaranteed faith.
If
you've got, absolutely, George. You have to have faith. You have to have conviction. Yeah. But at the same time, you need to be the kind of person who can change their mind. It's the whole, when the facts change, sir, I change my mind.
John Maynard Keynes?
Absolutely. One of the best. And they are diametrically opposed things. And yet we need to make peace with those.
From what you're saying, have to have an ability to recognize that you are going to have a different view to other people by definition.
Yes.
And you need to be okay with it. If you're looking for confirmation,
yes,
then you're going to A, not buy anything, and B, probably not be a very good investor.
You're going to make all kinds of mistakes. So again, one thing I'll do just to finish this up, the best thing you can do as an investor is write this stuff down. Why are you buying this share? When you come home at the end of the day and you talk to your other half and you say, honey, we bought some shares in X today. And she goes, why? You need to be able to give a really good answer. If you can't, what the hell are you doing? You are investing on hope. You're speculating, and it is a disaster. And then not only that, you also have to be able to say, now, there are people that inevitably disagree with me, and their argument would be X. Write it down. Because what I guarantee you, a month later, 6 months later, a year later, you will adjust your thinking to preserve this idea that you were right. We hate to admit we're wrong, so we will do all kinds of mental gymnastics to rationalize the reason why we're still right, even if the market's moving against us. So if you've got it written down, you can look back and say, well, this is the reason I bought the shares. It's clearly not the case anymore. I was wrong. Move on.
Andrew, somewhere in Melbourne, Liam is yelling at the top of his voice, will you guys please stop this bloody podcast? You've been rabbiting on for ages.
Yeah.
Can good we do call. That?
Let's do that. All right. Mate, let's put the tail on this. Don't forget, you can subscribe to the Triple M Motley Fool Money podcast, your iTunes, or your favorite Android podcast app.
And you should.
And if you like what we're doing, please give us a nice big fat 5-star rating.
Also, go to fool.com.au/Triple M.
That's it.
And leave your email address. We'll send you an email.
Awesome, mate. Until next time, fool on.
The Motley Fool and people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. General advice only. Please speak to your financial professional to understand how it may pertain to your situation. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM. The Motley Fool operates under Financial Services License 400691.